Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Welcome to the last episode of Still Watching Falcon and the Winter Soldier. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
I'm Anthony Bresnikan, the LA correspondent.
We have a little unusual episode for you today, but I'm really excited about it. We are doing sort of like a wrap-up mailbag. We did something similar with WandaVision. So Anthony and I are here to talk about some of your emails that you sent in. Thank you so much. We also have a great interview with Sarah Finn, who's the longtime casting director at Marvel headquarters. So she talked to me about, you know, over a decade of casting Marvel projects. And that was really interesting, especially considering, you know, how long ago Sebastian Stan, et cetera, joined. And we talked about Julie Louis-Dreyfus, talked about all of it. So you will hear from Sarah at the end of the episode. Richard Lawson is not with us today. We are joined instead by a very special guest. Rebecca Theodore Vachon is here. She's a film and TV critic. And she is also the creator of The Spectrum Lounge, which is a podcast that highlights creatives of color in Hollywood and pop culture. The New York Times, RogerEbert.com, Entertainment Weekly. We are so thrilled to have her. Rebecca, hello. How are you?
Hi. Hello. Welcome, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Of course. We brought you up on the show a couple times.
And yeah. Yes, you did. Thank you for the shout outs.
You do great work. You and Robert Young at your recaps and distillation of everything that's going on in the Falcon and the Winter Soldier was really great. Her co-host on the show on the Spectrum Lounge is Air Force veteran, so he brought a really cool perspective on that life experience to what was going on with Sam and Bucky in this show.
Yeah, so we are here. Rebecca has been looking at your emails along with us, and we picked out a few that we want to address. I wanted to start. I'm just going to dive right in, guys. And also, you can always email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Right now, of course, we're also doing, Richard and I are doing Mare of Easttown for HBO. We will probably all be back for Loki in June. I know I said it was like a question, but it's probably not a question. We'll probably be back for Loki. So you can get your Loki questions in now if you want. stillwatchingpod@gmail.com is the place to contact us. But I wanted to start with this question of legacy, which is something that was really interesting, at least to Rebecca and to me. And I want to start with this email from Michael. Wrote about every character, but this is a section he wrote on Sharon. He said, I agree with all that has been said on the storyline. Big ugh. The one thing that got me, like so many others, was the abandonment by Steve and Sam. How the show approached her missing year story makes Steve and Sam into assholes from the terrible Civil War. It went, thanks for the kiss and the equipment, but peace out. It was all you ever meant to us. This is not track at all with how the creators have been presenting. The characters have been presented in all of their appearances. to just up and forget about her. Like, what? This whole situation, I guess, showed us that Steve was not perfect. I really don't want to think about it. The more I do, the more upset I am at what they did and what they're trying to do it, you know, what it does to me. And I wanted to bring up, so Steve's legacy there and the way in which the Sharon storyline impacts that, but also the way in which Sharon's story impacts the Peggy Carter legacy. And then also something that was really interesting that, I've heard Rebecca talk about a little bit is the way in which Isaiah's timeline impacts Peggy and Howard Stark and their legacies. So Rebecca, I want to start with you and like just hear your thoughts on what you think the show is trying to say about the legacies of these MCU greats, Steve, Peggy, Howard, et cetera.
Well, you know, the first thing that comes to mind, my co-host who helped me, Robert Young, who helped me to recap Falcon and the Winter Soldier, he said something really profound to me. When he thinks about Steve Rogers, he says that, you know, Steve Rogers is incorruptible, but he's not infallible. And I think that's something that's really important. And I actually think that this is something that excites me going into phase four of the MCU, because the first three stages were basically setting up, you know, the respective franchises and their interactions with each other, with the Avengers and leading into Infinity War and Endgame. And I mean, honestly, who wants perfect characters, right? Like, just because you have superpowers doesn't mean that you're perfect. And I think this is something that is maybe sort of like in the cultural zeitgeist right now, because we're living in these very dark and uncertain times. We can look at, you know, Watchmen, the HBO series. We can look at The Boys, the Amazon series, which just wrapped up its second season, and then Invincible. Oh my God, I'm so obsessed with that show. But it's really like these shows are like these examinations of like the fallibilities of these people that have, you know, not only superpowers, but privilege, right? Because for me, a lot of the power that these characters have is a metaphor or symbolizes some sort of, I would say, privilege in the way that they move in the world, you know, access and power. So I actually think it's kind of cool for us not to see Steve as perfect. If you watch Civil War, I mean, depending on what day that I wake up, sometimes I'm on Steve's side, sometimes I'm on Tony's side. I think both of them were right and both of them were wrong. I mean, was it wrong for him to keep that secret from Tony that Bucky killed his parents? Perhaps. But, you know, I mean, I understand his rationalization for it. Right. I mean, yeah. But I think some of that had to do, there was some selfishness there too. Right. In the fact that Bucky is really his only living connection. Right. And that just kind of, I think it extends to the other characters in the MCU. Right. I just revisited Agent Carter. Mm-hmm. A couple of weeks ago. And I mean, you know, Howard Stark, I mean, Dominic Cooper is a very, the younger Howard Stark, he's a very, you know, charismatic actor. But I mean, watching Agent Carter again, I was like, wow, Howard Stark was really a jerk. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. And just this idea, because if you look at season one of Agent Carter, it's really about, one of the main storylines is really about Peggy having to retrieve these weapons of mass destruction that Howard had hidden. He had hidden them in a vault in his mansion, and somebody basically cut a hole in the floor and stole all of it. And so every episode was sort of like a MacGuffin type where, you know, it was like a poison gas or, you know, something that could blow up five city blocks. And it was like, wow. I mean, for you to wake up in the morning to think about things that would actually harm and kill human beings, I mean, that's something to examine. I mean, we do see Tony trying to wrestle with that legacy throughout the Iron Man trilogy. But yeah, I mean, not everybody's part. Nick Fury's made some questionable decisions. I think everybody, if you look at any character in the MCU, there's some not so nice stuff there, you know, but I think that's a reflection of real life.
Totally. And I think that's what makes the MCU characters so interesting. I just think that like, I just have weirdness around Steve in that regard, because there is, I'm definitely willing to accept a lot of fallibility in Steve. Yeah. Ditching Sharon is not a pocket that I feel like I can like comfortably put that in. I don't know, Anthony, what do you think?
I've always thought that one of the most interesting things about superheroes in general, whether it's Marvel or DC or what have you, is you have the ability to do great things and to save people and to help people, but you cannot save everybody. So somewhere when you're stopping that bus from going off a cliff, someone is drowning, when you're stopping that plane from crashing, someone is getting hit by a subway or falling into traffic, you know, like, and that there's always something that you're going to, in your back of your mind, say, I wish I could have done differently. And I think maybe, I don't mean to use this term in a callous way, but maybe Sharon Carter was just collateral damage, that there was so much rage after Civil War. Everybody was on the run. There's limited, Steve has limited abilities to help her. He can't pardon her, you know? And I just think sometimes people mess up and they don't, you know, they don't check all other people the way they should, and don't follow up on the things that they should follow up on. Ask my inbox about that.
I don't know that, as much as I agree with so much of what you're saying, especially Rebecca, what you're saying about the flawed nature of these Marvel characters. I don't know that I'll ever be convinced that Steve would kind of forget about Peggy, about Sharon. However, I do want to reference this interview that Malcolm Spellman, the show's creator and head writer, gave to the Fade to Black podcast, where he talked about what they wanted for Sharon here was to give her a place to move from in the MCU. And let me just introduce my sort of like my big brain theory of what happened to Sharon Carter. They introduced Sharon Carter in Winter Soldier. She's sort of a small part of the tapestry there. And they sort of they put their foot on the gas in terms of making her this like modern day love interest for Steve in Civil War. And one of the reasons, and we're going to talk about Bucky and his sexuality in a bit, but one of the reasons that a lot of people feel like that happened in Civil War, that kiss happened at all, was to counteract this very popular Steve and Bucky fan shipping thing narrative that was going on, and to like really straighten out Steve in a way by giving him like a girl to smooch in that movie. Whether or not that's true, what is true is that Sharon, like in that film, and it's not Emily Van Camp's fault, Sharon wasn't like a popular character after that film. I think this goes back to something that you and I have talked about a lot, Anthony, like Kevin Feige's desire to like fix things that didn't work perfectly the first time they tried it. Like we talked about Ultron and some other things. And I think they wanted to say, okay, let's make Sharon really interesting to people. And something that your co-host said, Rebecca, was like that Sharon was never interesting to him before, but now she's kind of interesting in this power broker position. And he's kind of interested to see like where she moves from here and how she goes. And so like, I can understand why they wanted to put her here, to put her in a place that was really interesting to viewers. I feel like with a lot of this Falcon Winter Soldier stuff, they might have skipped like three steps in order to get there. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yep, I agree. I agree with that.
I get what they wanted to give her, and I just don't feel like they fully, you know, justified putting her there. But now that she's there, it is a more interesting place for her to be than just sort of like helpful girl Friday, quasi love interest sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, and it also gives her a little bit of agency, I think. And I mean, like you were saying, Joanna, about when we talk about legacies, because we know Sharon is Peggy's niece, you know, that last episode when she was given that pardon, and it was that senator that was like, welcome back, Agent Carter. And that just gave me chills, like, wow, you know what I mean? But of course, now it's sort of like this idea of Peggy. We knew Peggy to just be like this really good and moral person. And now her niece could potentially be going rogue. We don't really know who she's talking to on the phone. But I just want to remind people really quick, and this was a conversation that I had in my podcast, is the fact that, again, when we look at these characters, you know, they're not as perfect as they seem. Because for all of the heroics that Peggy did, let's remember, she is the co-founder. She is one of the co-founders of S.H.I.E.L.D. And we know S.H.I.E.L.D. has done some underhanded stuff. And part of, you know, we understood this in Winter Soldier, is that S.H.I.E.L.D. recruited some former Hydra scientists like Dr. Zola. You know what I mean? Which is really a reflection of real life American history, where the American government welcomes certain, you know, former Nazi scientists and doctors.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's a question there of like, really? These are the people that you want, you know, in your circle. So there's something to be examined there.
I think her storyline also presents a zag to everybody else's zig. Like, you've got Bucky, who's trying to come back from having been the bad guy as the Winter Soldier. You've got even John Walker, like, he's heading toward being a bad guy, but he thinks he's going a different direction in his own brain. You've got Sam kind of going in circles because he's just not sure what path is the right one for him, whether he should pick up the shield. Obviously, he gives it away and doesn't think he should take it. Then he decides he does want to do it, but Isaiah gives him advice, tells him what not to do. And with Sharon, you have somebody who's like, I've been a good guy for a while now, and this sucks, and I've been discarded. I'm going to go bad, right? You guys, she's going the other direction down the freeway when there's a traffic jam. Everybody going one way. She's like, I'm just going to turn around and I'm going to go bad. And I'll see you guys when I see you.
Well, something that's and something to bear in mind, and something that Rebecca was saying on her show, is that there's nothing Marvel loves more than redeeming a bad guy, right? And we'll talk about that in terms of in terms of John Walker, and certainly like the best example, as Rebecca pointed out, is Loki. But like, if they put Sharon in this position where she's doing this thing, she feels justified in what she's doing, and maybe she's gonna come back to the light. On an arc that we're going to see play out over, you know, maybe she's going to be part of Armor Wars. Maybe she's going to be part of Secret Invasion. Like, we don't know. Certainly they're setting her up to be part of something else going forward. But, I just thought that was interesting. All right. I want to talk about, the Bucky of it all. So on that same podcast, the Fade to Black podcast, that's where, Malcolm Spellman's first quote a couple weeks ago about sort of like, watch this space for Bucky's sexual identity. That's where his first quote came from. And then in this follow-up interview, which he did after everything was said and done, he's sort of like, I kind of regret saying, I didn't know that people would latch onto that. He's still learning the way in which everyone in the Marvel fandom latches onto like every single thing that someone says. So here's an email we got from Lee about Bucky, who says, it sucks to think that Spellman said to keep watching, knowing full well that there would be no further exploration or acknowledgement of any queer potential. It was almost reminiscent of when Teen Wolf actively used the fans' desires for their ship to come true to keep people watching. I wish you just said that they didn't realize Tigers on Tinder had queer connotations, or that that wasn't their intention, or something along those lines, rather than suggest that we might get something we've wanted for ages. Your discussion about the keep watching comment from Malcolm Spellman very quickly veered into shipping territory. And while shipping is absolutely an important part of any fandom, and maybe especially this one, I feel like that missed the mark a little. I won't speak for other queer people, but it is less important for me that Bucky ends up with any particular man than for him to be able to maybe exist as a queer character. So often queer characters and properties like this are shoved into safe and stable relationships because they will be less threatening to straight viewers if they're already taken, which is something we're seeing with the Eternals. An unattached queer character is too unstable, too risky. So the solution is to immediately put them in the most normative institutions known to man, marriage and parenthood. So this is a bigger MCU question we are sort of like teetering on the brink of Marvel hopefully not being afraid to just let gay people exist in their universe.
Yeah. I mean, I've been witness to the Bucky is queer shipdom. I've seen the shipdom for Bucky and Steve, right? That was like from first Avengers. So that's almost like a decade old. I've seen the ship with Bucky and Sam. I've seen the ship with Bucky and Zemo. There's all sorts of, you know, and fanfic plays a huge part of that. I think the larger problem, like you said, it's not Bucky specifically. The larger problem is actually the MCU's Achilles heel, one of its lack of queer representation, right? And not only the lack of it, what they're also guilty of in some ways is what we call queer baiting, right? Where it's this idea of presenting these characters of, oh, they could possibly be, you know, romantically interested in each other, and then they go their straight hetero ways. You know what I mean? And so it's a way to kind of a marketing tool in some ways to bring in the queer community. And so you have a lot of queer viewers, which I think they're right that they feel that they're being used. Like, okay, you want my viewership and you want my, you know, you want my ticket money, you want me to watch the show and live tweet about it or whatever. But it would be nice if we could actually see ourselves and our, you know, sexual preferences you know, reflected in that. And of course, you'll have people that are like the same people who are screaming about comic book movies shouldn't be about politics. You'll have people that are screaming about, oh, what does someone's sexuality have to do with it? Well, you didn't ask that question when when Pepper and Tony were getting it on throughout the whole, you know, we have quite a few hetero pairings mm-hmm. in the MCU. Yeah. So, mm-hmm. you know, like Star-Lord and Gamora. So, I mean, yes, clearly the heterosexual representation is there in Marvel. And so I think it is only fair that the queer community is asking, where is ours, right? And I think that what hasn't helped Marvel is that we've been hearing these stories, like the fact that, you know, we know that the Valkyrie character that was introduced mm-hmm. in Ragnarok is supposed to be bisexual. But we didn't see that. And from what I understand, that there was a scene where there was supposed to be some woman leaving out of Valkyrie's apartment. So it would be hinted that they had some sort of, you know, right. sexual mm-hmm. that got cut out. And then a couple of years ago, I remember these were early screenings of Black Panther, where there was a scene between, I think it was the Okoye character and Io.
I saw that footage.
You saw it. Okay. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. they were like, there was definitely some chemistry, mm-hmm. but it made the cutting floor. So there's sort of like this history of like almost getting there and then they just kind of pull back, you know what I mean? But I will say this, as far as, and I think that Marvel, if they really think about it, I think now that they're in phase four, they are totally ready to have like queer characters, and not in some queer baiting way or in some, you know, afterthought in a press release where it's like, oh yeah, by the way, they were, you know, they were bisexual or whatever. But actually committing to that, I think they're in a space right now. They make billions of dollars. Anybody who decides not to watch a Marvel movie because two men kiss, I mean, that's something you need to talk to your therapist about. I don't know. I mean, people were, you know, complaining about Falcon and the Winter Soldier dealing too much with race, but that didn't stop them from tuning in. So
yeah, and we're gonna talk about that in a second. Anthony, I wanna hear what you have to say about this.
I think my kids are gonna grow up, and what they're gonna say, looking back at the pop culture of their childhood, is how come I didn't see anybody like my friend's two moms in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, or my friend's two dads, right? Like, mm-hmm. they know LGBTQ people in their real lives, and they're not seeing them on screen, and they have no problem with it. They're not confused or baffled or torn up by it, or, you know, disturbed. Like, you know, there's always that, what about the children? How do you explain this to the children? It's very easy. It's very easy to explain it to children. You know, what I've explained to my kids was, as long as you're old enough and the person is good to you, you can love whoever you like. And I think that's very easy for a kid to understand, even if they're before the age where they understand sex and sexuality and all of that. They understand love. What I wanted to say is, and I've mentioned this before, talking about other Marvel properties, is that I think one of the successes of the Marvel Cinematic Universe is that it makes you really care about the characters, makes you care about the heroes. In one way, one of the ways it does that is it gives them other people in their lives that they love, that they care about. You care about mm-hmm. Tony because he loves Pepper. You care about Steve Rogers because he loves Bucky, you know, and those two have a thing, whatever that thing is, it's there. And all of the characters, even the Guardians of the Galaxy, they all have this sort of grudging love and respect for each other, and they care about each other, and that makes you care about them. And I'm thinking of this documentary called Disclosures, and it's a Netflix doc directed by Sam Fader, and it's about trans representation in Hollywood, or misrepresentation in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And one of the people that Sam interviews talks about how important it is to have trans characters in popular entertainment, because audiences who may not know somebody or may not be aware that somebody they know is has a different sexuality than what's heteronormative, they'll see a character in a movie and they care about that character, and therefore that they'll see, like, a trans actor playing a character in a movie, they'll care about that character, and then that empathy gets transmitted to the actor or to other people like that in real life. And it almost, fiction has the power to spark empathy in people who may be unaware of their surroundings. And I think that's why it's important to have queer characters in the Marvel Cinematic Universe and in Star Wars and these other big things, because it's a good way to spark empathy in people who may just be living in a little bit of a bubble or have blinders on. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I think obviously, I mean, we should talk about another factor in this conversation, which is the Chinese market, right? This idea that like the Chinese market is much more
right.
You know, unreceptive to this subject than the American market, and that Marvel has catered to the Chinese market, like in, you know, throughout its run. So, but I wanted to talk about something that Malcolm Spellman, this, I think maybe the last time I referenced this interview, but maybe not. The one of the things that he said about Marvel's enduring desire to appeal to the entire audience, if you want to put it that way, which is Eamon asked him in this interview on the Fade to Black podcast, like, this is obviously a show about race and about racism, but you never say the word racism or racist in the show. Sort of, was that a conscious decision? Like, why, you know, why is that the case? And Malcolm was saying, you know, because of the way that the Marvel fandom responded to Black Panther, because of the way that they responded to Killmonger, they felt like they didn't have to underline what they were saying, that anyone with, like, you know, two brain cells to rub together could see that that was what the show was about, so that they could do it. But something that he was saying, and then I'm reading a little bit between the lines, but not that deeply between the lines. Something he was saying is, by not saying it explicitly, they don't risk alienating the people who might say, you're bringing too many political issues into this, or might feel quote unquote alienated, which is something that like frustrates me that Marvel would try to cater to that audience. But at the same time, like, that, you know, Marvel is trying to make four quadrant entertainment, but something like they explicitly don't say race or racism or racist in this show about race. And that was a conscious choice.
It's one of those show don't tell things. Like, I don't think anybody has to turn to the camera and say like, and now a word about racism.
Well,
like,
that's, I mean, that's sort of what Malcolm is saying. And it wasn't a complaint. It was an observation. Yeah. It was was this sort of an explicit thing? Like,
I think the line, no self-respecting Black man would carry that shield, nor would he want to. Like, that's pretty.
That's very loaded.
But that it was a conscious decision they made to not alienate a certain audience. That is something that Malcolm Spellman said. So, you know, I just think that that is interesting. And I didn't notice the lack of the words racism or racist in the show, because I felt from the beginning, as was very apparent, that this was what this show was about. But I think that it is interesting that that's a conscious decision they made.
Yeah. And you know what? And the thing is, like, when I think about Falcon and Winter Soldier, I mean, people debate whether they should have used the word racism or race. I feel like the way they did it, I don't think you needed that. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, one of the main word that I was getting watching, one of the main things I was getting watching Falcon and Winter Soldier is white supremacy. And that is a word and a term that a lot of white people cannot wrap their heads around. They're like, well, I'm not racist. Okay. You don't have a white sheet in your closet. That's great. And, you know, well, my parents, my ancestors didn't own slaves. But the thing with white supremacy is that you don't actually have to actively participate in it to benefit from it. You know what I mean? Like, that's the thing that people, and it's such a scary word. They just think of like burning crosses and the KKK and lynching, which, yes, absolutely, that's part of it. But, you know, white supremacy, and I think that was something that I was catching, whatever Malcolm was throwing, is the fact that white supremacy is just so insidious that it works in very subtle ways too. It's not just the macro, but it's also the micro, right? Like, a perfect example is like when Sam decided he didn't want to be Captain America, right? And he gave the shield back to the American government. Mm-hmm. And then they turned around and they picked a white guy, you know what I mean? Like a beta Cap, a beta version of Steve Rogers. Mm-hmm. That you didn't have to say anything, but we knew what that was about. It was about white supremacy. They were saying the man that needs to carry this shield needs to be white.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And there, a lot of people were circulating at the time this thing from the comic book, from the Sam Wilson comic book, that is like a senator character saying like, we can't have a Black man as Captain America. Like, it's said explicitly on the page, mm-hmm. and it's implicit in the show, but I don't think you need them to say it for it to be very clear that that's what's going on there.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Sometimes messages are delivered more effectively when they're a little more subtle, you know, and not always, but like, it's sort of like, you know, when you don't even know the shot has gone in, you're like, wait, when do I get my shot? Like, it's there. It's in you. It's in the show you're enjoying. They did use the word supremacist. They didn't preface it with white, but you remember Zemo uses the word several times where he's like, anybody who wants to take the super soldier serum, like, and is a supremacist. Now, maybe the metaphor there that Spellman and his writing team is playing off of is the notion of super soldier serum as a cheat, right? A super soldier serum is white privilege. Is that you, if you have that, you can get away with more, right? You get a benefit of the doubt more, or you just have, you're a few steps ahead. And, you know, maybe that's what this was all about, was who's the supremacist. You know, he did not preface it with white, but he did use that word, which I remember thinking, like, well, that's a heavy word, you know, that's a heavy bit of dialogue.
The funny thing is I found it so ironic, because that is actually one of my favorite lines from Falcon and the Winter Soldier, where Zemo talks about that, about the pursuit of being superpowered is supremacist. Mm-hmm. But then I was laughing, because I was just like, bruh, you are like a wealthy white man, like, you are a supremacist in your own way. Well, you don't have the super serum running through your veins. You have money and resources. You know what I mean? Like, that makes you a different type of superpower.
I want to talk about how white supremacy and white privilege translates over to the John Walker storyline, because especially his ending here, because we got a couple emails about the John Walker ending and how people felt about, like, did he wind up here in this place of, like, quasi pardon, because the MCU just wants him in a place where they can use him in the future. And then that's what Christelle wrote in, and Robert wrote in and said, like, I know the problem is more that John's downfall took 4 episodes and his redemption only took 1, but I thought it would maybe spark an interesting conversation. I personally would rather him go after Carly in that last second instead of the hostages, and solidify that Sam represents what America could be and John represents what America is. But one of the more interesting questions around this moment with Julia Louis-Dreyfus's character Val and John in the end here is something. Okay, this really is the last time I'm going to reference this Malcolm Spellman interview. We don't know exactly who Val is and who she's working for and how much of a governmental representation she is. The fact that it appeared that John was getting that costume in the same courtroom where he was stripped of his title earlier, I think might be a function of them having Julia Louis-Dreyfus for literally one day more than anything else. But they kept those flags up. So the flags are up in that room that makes it feel somewhat official that he is this U.S. agent, right? We don't know who exactly she's working for, but the comparison that Malcolm Spellman made several times is to Oliver North, who is a real figure in U.S. political history, involved in the Iran-Contra scandal, and pardoned, just completely got away with stuff that he fully admitted that he did. And Malcolm Spellman was saying, like, this is what they let people get away with. And he didn't say this explicitly, but, like, this is what they let white men get away with, right? In service of, you know, the dirtier deeds that America does. And we shouldn't be surprised that John Walker – I think my surprise is more like that Bucky and Sam are not colder to John than they are in the end there. But I'm not that surprised that he sort of, like, got away with it governmentally. But I don't know. I was just wondering what you guys thought about if we wanted to revisit again that John Walker ending, maybe starting with you, Rebecca.
Clearly, John Walker is sort of – representative of white male power, white male privilege. You know, as I said, that in episode 5, when they had the trial, right? And they were like, okay, we're giving you everything short of an honorable discharge. I want viewers to be very clear on this. They weren't really upset at John Walker killing that man. They were upset at the fact that he did it in front of cameras and people saw it, right? Because again, they picked him. They cherry picked this man to carry the mantle of Captain America. And if you go back to episode 2, you know, where he had that huge introduction when he was doing the Good Morning America segment, and the reporter said, yeah, you know, when you you know, when you were chosen to be Captain America, you went through a whole battery of tests, right? So not only physical, but psychological, much like the military, much like the police, you have to go through a psychological profile to see if you are fit for service. Now, seeing everything that John Walker has done, we know that this man is not playing with a full deck. To me, I'm pretty sure that he did not pass the psychological testing. I think they knew that this man was a murder bot, and that's why they picked him. Because think about, when you think about Steve was never able to be controlled by the government. He was always rogue. You know what I mean? And like, we just saw him in full form in Infinity War. We called him Bearded Rogue Cat. You know what I mean? That was our nickname for him. But if you watch from First Avenger, Steve was always going against the grain. He was always questioning government and authority. And I think this time for their new Captain America, they were like, we don't want any of that. We don't want anyone who thinks for himself. We don't want anyone showing agency. Mm-hmm. We want a career soldier. And that's exactly who they got. And it was really, I think that the whole trial and the court martial, to me, it was just performance. And we see the American government do this all the time, where they do things and it's only when they're caught. And then that's when they give an apology and they're like, oh, okay. So to me, that last scene, going to back to what you said, Joanna, the fact that John is walking out with that new uniform in that same courtroom tells me that there's some sort of government complicity in here. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's just working for Val. I think the government is like, let's do a reboot. You can't be Captain America, but let's make you something else.
And off the books cap, you know, and like, mm-hmm. I think that something our producer Dave said to me, like his theory, we've been talking a lot about this idea of like the Thunderbolts, a group of either villains or antiheroes that, depending on your definition, that could be sort of building up here in the Marvel universe. And Dave's pet theory is that Val is working for Thunderbolt Ross, who is technically Secretary of State, so can't do this thing himself. But is having Val, sort of, if you think of the analog of, Dave didn't fully go with me on this, but like, if you think of the analog, if she's the Nick Fury and then Ross is sort of the Robert Redford character, the like level above, Nick Fury, right? And, so she's running these folks that she might be popping around, gathering from various shows and films in the service of Thunderbolt Ross. And that's why they might eventually be called the Thunderbolts anyway. Let's say, speaking of sort of this idea of like Sam representing what America can be and John maybe representing what America is, let's talk about Sam's speech at the end. Mm. We talked about it a bit. We got some emails about it. Rebecca, how did that speech land with you?
I mean, it was a little long, but the thing with me is that I thought it was a very impactful speech, because I mean, this was his debut as Captain America. The same way, what was that episode 4 that was called "The Whole World Is Watching"? Mm-hmm. So this was like "The Whole World Is Watching 2.0," and it's like, okay, let's see what it looks like when somebody really heroic, you know, steps up for the country. So I think what he said was dead on. I mean, and the thing that I caught, it was just really something that I wanted to talk about, is that I noticed that we saw that Sam was continually advocating and trying to reach out to Carly, even with everything that she did, even though she mm-hmm. bombed that GRC building. You know, there was a compassion and an empathy that he had for her that other people didn't have, right? And, you know, Zemo was like, we got to take her out. That's it. You know what I mean? And other people that just had really strong feelings about her. And Sam kind of stood as this buffer. You know what I mean? And I think that there's a significance of that, of this Black man who is advocating for this mixed race woman, right? Because the actress is half Black, half white. So I'm assuming Carly's identity is the same. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he kept calling her, and especially in the speech and throughout the show, he would continually refer to Carly as a kid or as a teen, right? And the reason why that is so important is that when we look at real life, when we look at Tamir Rice, a young Black boy that was killed, murdered by the police because he had a BB gun, right? Or when we look at Mike Brown, and they said that he was this big hulking man, is there's this, and this has been proven in studies that white people, when they tend to look at brown children and Black children, they tend to adultify them. They add at least another 4, 5, 6 years to them. Right. So Tamir Rice was only like 11, 12. And the cops were saying, oh, he looks 17, 18. When clearly, if you Google this child's face, he looked like a little cherub. You know what I mean? So there's this idea of, of projecting, adultifying them, projecting like these very negative and savage traits to them, especially if they're darker skinned. And so I think that was what Sam was trying to do, is that he was continually, even in her death, is that he was advocating for her innocence and the fact that this teenage girl, while you may not agree with her methods, she was right on the money. You know what I mean? And basically calling out the senator and the members of the GRC, basically he was like, you guys need to get your ish together. Right. And I loved what he said. He was like, if you think Carly is bad, wait till Carly 2.0 comes out. Right. And but it's a very difficult conversation to have when we talk about terrorism. Right. How it is so easy to radicalize the youth. Right. Because they've been disenfranchised. They've seen these horrors. They're seeing drones dropping bombs on, you know, on their villages and killing their families or whatever. It's not that hard to recruit them, right? Not if you're feeding in on their hate. And so I think Sam, what he was doing in that speech, was really trying to hold the American government accountable, because the American government is part of the GRC. And this whole idea of, you know, displacement and moving people and recreating these fictional borders, it's not right. And so I think that's what Sam is trying to do, is that he's trying to stand up for the voiceless, for the people who don't have voices, for people who see these things. But I mean, how do you go up against the American government? You can't. And that's why you go to someone like Sam, right? And which is what Captain America should be. I don't think Captain America should be somebody who's advocating for the American government. I think it's supposed to be holding the American government accountable. When you're right, you're right. And when you're wrong, you're wrong.
I agree with that. And I also think that one of the things that makes that speech, Sam's speech, work is later when he's sort of given the too long didn't read to Isaiah while Isaiah's doing his gardening. You know, when Isaiah's like, I almost bought that. Right? But you keep a little bit of that skepticism, like maybe those are just pretty words, but it's also, God, you know, you have to have something to believe in, right?
Right,
there
right.
There has to be some guiding light, a beacon that you're headed toward. And I think Sam recognized that we need that. People need that. Our country needs that. Black Americans need that. White Americans need, everybody else, everybody needs it. And I'm going to try to fulfill that, and I'm going to be flawed, and it may be a whole flawed system, but at least we're trying to steer toward something better, you know? And I think that was what I took from that speech and what it all meant.
Yeah. And even like the interaction between that final scene you were talking about, Anthony, where he was like, yeah, you know, I almost fell for it or whatever. And there was something that Isaiah said to him. He said, well, you know, Malcolm, you know, Martin, you know, Mandela, but there's something special about you, right? And that whole conversation, just even episode 5, and especially that final conversation with Sam and Isaiah, to me is really a reflection of the conversations that Black Americans are having right here, right now, right? Mm-hmm. Because throughout the run of Falcon and the Winter Soldier, there's very strong feelings about the decision for Sam to take up the mantle of Captain America. Now, me personally, I was like, F that shield, throw it in the Potomac and let's keep it moving. That's how I feel about it. Like, I was like, you don't need to be Captain America because you're already a hero, right? Mm-hmm. Sam is such a good person, and he's following, he's carrying on the legacy of Steve, not Captain America, but the legacy of Steve Rogers and also Isaiah Bradley, right? Mm-hmm. But it was just sort of like, but there, when you look on Twitter on an average day, when these episodes air, there's such strong feelings, especially that last episode. People were so upset. Some people were like, no, I didn't want him to be Captain America. Other people were like, but I get it. Right. But this idea of hope and optimism. And I think that's where we are as a people, as Black Americans, that's where we feel right now. It's like, we are part of this country, but not. And you know, and then it's like on a day where you see, which, you know, a video of a Black person or a brown person being brutalized by the police or the military, being hit with tear gas, depending on what day you find me, it's like, yes, we can do better. And other times, like, I don't want to be bothered with this country. You know what I mean? That's sort of like the internal struggle that I feel is reflective of a lot of Black Americans that are watching this show.
There was something that Anthony Mackie said to me years and years ago when I visited him on the set of his first movie, Winter Soldier. And he said, it in kind of a joking way, but he said, you know, Steve Rogers and Sam Wilson would not have been friends when Steve was in his own time in the 40s. It's not that Steve would have hated him or harbored that kind of hostility in his heart. Their worlds would not have intersected. And he said, kind of jokingly, Steve wakes up in the 21st century and he gets a cell phone and a black friend. That's his opposite. You know, and like, that's a funny line, but it's also right. Like, yeah, he opened up Steve's mind to a world, an American experience that Steve was blind to. Came to know each other as soldiers first, right? Running around the Washington Monument. They became friends, but I think Sam opened Steve's eyes and made him a better Captain America for having known him, for having known a little bit of his experience. And now we see, you know, he's carrying on that legacy of Steve Rogers by picking up the shield, but also he helped build that legacy of Steve Rogers, which I think is also a powerful metaphor for what Black Americans contributed to this country.
Yeah, I mean, because you're touching on like what they call the magical Negro trope, right? Where it's like where a Black character, his sole purpose is to make the white character better, right?
I'm not saying that.
No. But I mean, I think maybe like when we saw Sam in like, you know, Winter Soldier and Civil War, that could have, he was veering into that. But I think this is why Falcon and the Winter Soldier, I forget which one of you said, there's a sort of course correction that Kevin Feige is trying to do. Yeah. I feel like Falcon and the Winter Soldier is sort of course correcting that by saying, no, Sam has his own identity. And I love the idea that he was wrestling with the idea of, should he be Captain America? That felt authentic to me.
Bouncing off of that, what you guys were talking about, I wanted to talk about the Steve of it all, because we got an email from someone, from Amy, who writes in to say, you know, this show is not telling a Steve Rogers story. They stopped talking about it about halfway through, and Steve's morality as a measure of what Captain America is supposed to be disappears as the more important judgment of Sam and Bucky and the audience take precedence. I wasn't thinking or caring about Steve after the initial setup of the relationships and issues, and I don't think the show wanted me to. And then Amy says, I think this is a rare moment when Joanna is asking a question that the show is not interested in and asking them to accomplish something that wasn't one of their goals. So I'm going to respond to this and then I want to hear what you guys have to say. I definitely don't mind someone disagreeing with me, but I'm going to disagree right back and say, I think Steve is looming over this whole thing, and how can he not be? Right. This is about his two friends finding each other, finding their way forward. This is about Sam not being Steve, but what are the qualities of a Captain America? What does Steve bring to the table? What does Isaiah bring to the table? What does John bring to the table? What does Sam bring to the table? And like, how can you not be constantly thinking about Steve? These are all characters, Sharon, et cetera, all characters that were circling around Steve while he was here. And something that, I have heard is that they were trying really hard to get a Chris Evans cameo, whether as old Steve or young Steve, I don't know, but like they really wanted a Chris Evans appearance in this show, and it didn't work out for them. And that's fine. I don't think the show needs it, but I disagree that the show didn't want us thinking about Steve the whole time. And I'm not saying that like Steve is the only Captain America for me. I'm really excited about Sam as Captain America, as much as I'm relieved that John Walker is no longer Captain America. But I'm just curious what you guys think about like Steve as a refraction point for all of these characters we're talking about here.
I mean, I would be on Twitter and Steve Rogers was trending almost every week when Falcon and the Winter Soldier was airing. So I don't know that it's accurate to say that, you know, like there was absence of Steve. Like we were always thinking about Steve. I mean, right. The show is really about the legacy. And specifically, I think the thing with Falcon and Winter Soldier, they did it well sometimes, better other times, is really separating the legacy of Steve Rogers and the legacy of Captain America, right? Where they converge and where they fall apart.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, like we said earlier, I mean, Steve was not perfect, but I think there's a goodness in him, and there is this willingness to say, you know what, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's a different way for me to do things. And I think that's why he gave Sam the series. And what's interesting about Sam, why I think Sam is going to make a really interesting Captain America once they burn that suit. I think the thing that I find so fascinating about Sam, and we saw this, is that he has this tremendous amount of empathy. Yeah. I don't know that we have that many superheroes, particularly male superheroes, that have that type of empathy. But that's bolstered by the fact that Sam has a history or a background as a counselor and as a therapist. I'm like, how many... Like, I'm just thinking to myself, like, how many superheroes do we have that have a psychologist or a therapist background? Usually they're going to the psychologist or therapist. Yeah. So I think it's actually really interesting to see how he's going to use these skills going forward in dealing with villains and antagonists or whatever. I think that's really fascinating to me.
The only two things I could think of were Jonathan Crane and Harley Quinn, both DC villains. So that's the legacy of psychiatry and comic books. All right, Rebecca opened the door to this, so I'm gonna walk through it. I polled Twitter about this, and Twitter was very divided, at least my followers, about the suit. I am not a fan of the suit. Anthony's not a fan of the suit. Plenty of people are. Rebecca, what are your thoughts here?
Oh, I hated it. Oh, I hated it. Oh, I hated that costume. I mean, like I said, I joked. I was like, the case that it came in looked better than the suit. I was just like, there was just a lot of like, you know, you see it's a Wakandan. It's from the Wakandans. And I'm like, ooh, I was expecting like some real high tech, you know, whatever. I mean, I understand that the suit that we saw in Falcon and the Winter Soldier is a more accurate representation of the comic book, and is very frustrating when you talk to comic book stands, and we're like, it's canon, and I'm like, but if you've been following the MCU, a lot of times Kevin Feige has basically said F the canon. There has been a lot, like the story of Civil War, the Civil War movie is not really like the comic book.
Scarlet Witch's and Vision's comic book costumes are Halloween costumes in WandaVision. You know?
I understand that they wanted to be faithful to the comic book, but sometimes that real world adaptation, it just looked really puffy. I like the wings. You know, I like some of the Wakandan upgrades that they gave to his wings, but I was not a fan of this suit. It's too loud. There's a lot of white going on.
Yeah.
It's just very, very loud.
I wasn't stealthy at all, that's for sure. Something that I did want to say, that a lot of people brought this up, and it's completely true, that like Steve Rogers himself went through many, many suits, and some of his early suits are really doofy. The best way to know that is when Steve in Endgame has to change from his like nomad look into what he wore in Joss Whedon's Avengers, and he just looks dumb. And you're like, oh yeah, that's what it used to look like. So, you know, Sam will probably get some upgrades, hopefully, as it goes along. And my understanding is that Anthony Mackie himself really wanted the comic book suit. He's such a handsome, like, man. I really wanted this moment to be this big, powerful moment. And I was like, oh no, I don't like the suit. Anthony, any further suit questions?
One of our listeners, Fred, sent a message and said it looked like he could have gotten it in line behind John Walker at Party City and get a suit. Which I was like, oh, you know, would Sam really, wouldn't he be more of a Spirit Halloween kind of guy? But I thought, oh yeah, it's a little costumey rather than a uniform. I think that's what you should go for, is like what looks like a uniform rather than a costume. But I look back at pictures from when my wife graduated from library school, and I've always been pretty square. And she said, why don't you let your hair grow long? And I let it grow down to my shoulders, and we don't keep those pictures around anymore. And I have a feeling that, you know, that this era will also be one that future Captain America Sam Wilson does not have hanging on his wall. Like, let's get a different photo up. One about this puffy, super colorful suit. I think we're kind of nitpicking. It was okay. It just wasn't. I don't think it didn't have the texture to it that you would expect.
They do a lot of like that fine mesh sort of look on a lot of the MCU suits now, and T'Challa's suit was great. Like, give Sam something a little better. Let's go really quickly to my interview with Sarah Finn before we wrap up the episode.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
By asking you, because Falcon and the Winter Soldier is so much about finding a new Captain America, you know, what qualities initially about Chris Evans spoke to you when casting First Avenger?
You may be aware, it was a long process, right? Finding our first Captain America, our first Avenger. And we kind of went round and round and came back to Chris. I think that really what he embodied that we were looking for were sort of the obvious external qualities, right? He was American. We've cast a lot of Brits, but we wanted to cast an American and a great actor and, you know, funny and charming and affable and all of that. But then beyond the sort of obvious qualities, I think there were the other ones that were a little harder to discern, right? The internal qualities, his humility, the sense that he had a moral compass, that he was very relatable, that he had this vulnerability as well as strength, so that we could take him from Skinny Steve, you know, to Captain America, because that was such an important part of the journey. And Chris was a bit reluctant to take on the role in the first place. And so ironically, that made him all the more ripe for it. And all the more appealing, the sense that he was reluctant to be a star. He kind of had that modesty. He embodied that, all of the qualities that we were going for. So we were really very, very excited and knew we had arrived, you know, when he agreed to play the part.
Chris has said over the years that sort of the playing Steve has kind of rubbed off on him, that he feels like some of Steve's quality has sort of been translated onto his personality. Do you agree with that? Or do you think those were things that were always there that you always saw in him, you know?
The latter. I think they were always there. I think they were always there. Yeah. I would say that, yeah, they were latent and coming out as the more he inhabited the character, you know, and the more that he kind of resonated with those qualities.
And what about finding Sebastian Stan? This is a character. I mean, there's much been said about his contract and how in the early days, perhaps it was for 9 film roles. How does that change what you're looking for?
I hadn't heard that it was 9 film roles till this. So I'm going to admit that it didn't, I wasn't thinking that far ahead, you know, when we were looking at Sebastian for that role. And I think, though, that there's a common theme, right, when we're casting any of these roles, to go with the most interesting, most complex, most skilled actors, so that hopefully they can go a long distance, you know? And I think it's been so exciting and gratifying to see where Sebastian's come. So, and again, originally, this may be known that he was auditioning for Captain America. But we saw something there that was a bit darker, a bit edgier. And as we continued to go through the process, it seemed like the best role might be Bucky. And so we had some of the heroic qualities, but there was a darkness that he had to, of course, kind of transcend, and to get to see him evolve over the course of this journey in the last decade has been kind of amazing. So again, yeah, I think that is even knowing it was 9 films or not, I think that it would have guided the process in the same way.
How much do they, you know, when you say we saw darkness in him, so, you know, you think about Bucky, and obviously in the first Avenger, that darkness isn't there yet for Bucky. But how much do you know at the time then that you're going to go down a Winter Soldier path, or you at least want to have the potential to do that?
When I was casting Captain America, the first Avenger, I was not yet, this was still early on in my relationship with Marvel. And I did not understand how far this was all going to go. I really had no idea. When Kevin was first talking about the Avengers movie, that was mind blowing to me. So I will admit I was just looking to cast the best person for the role that I was focused on. And sort of, I think, have continued to do that, you know, and look for those, I think, what might be connective tissue in the MCU in terms of the qualities in the actors that that willing to be playful, the intense amount of skill and intent and discipline and passion that they bring to it. But really, I think every time we sort of going up to bat and just hoping to hit it out of the park with that one part.
When you cast someone for a role, like let's say Emily Van Camp for Sharon Carter, and then she has this turn in this show, which is not necessarily the prompt for the original Sharon Carter character in Winter Soldier. Have there been other instances like that where the twists and turns of the MCU, nothing in future, just stuff we've already seen, has required an actor to do something that you weren't initially looking for in them?
Over and over again. And it's been really wonderful and really fun for me to get to see the actors flex and spread their wings. And I'll give you a couple examples and we can go right to WandaVision, you know, with Lizzie Olsen and Paul, what they did, and we knew they had comedic ability, but what they did in that show was mind-blowing. I thought just so accomplished in terms of their flexibility and agility as actors. I think another one that was a really wonderful surprise and wonderful to see how the audiences reacted was Chris Hemsworth as Thor. As Ragnarok came out and as the Avengers film came out, he hadn't had the opportunity to be so funny. And so I think that was another one where it was a very different thing, which was a challenging role at the time, to find an actor who could kind of play Asgardian, which we equated to Shakespearean almost, and yet be completely earthbound and relatable. So we weren't necessarily testing out his comedic ability way back then, but then he grew and has been able to really thrive.
Speaking of like the Hemsworth and Evans of it all, you know, how do you go casting about a major role when the producers, the directors are asking for an unknown?
Well, fortunately for me, I think that I've never really gotten a requirement from producers or filmmakers other than please find the best person. Now, sometimes that ends up requiring an unknown, but I would say that every single process has been different, and it's often really dictated by the vision of the filmmaker and what they want. But in certain circumstances, it's kind of identifying the landscape, who's out there. And at certain times we have had to then roll up our sleeves and say, this is going to be a big search. For example, Peter Parker, we knew when we were going into that, I think we all felt we wanted it to be fresh. We wanted it to be something different. We wanted it to be someone very young and youthful. And so that ended up being a very, very wide search that took a long time, and we saw thousands of people.
What do you look for in that emerging talent in looking for a Tom Holland? And what is your process like? Are you a theater goer? Do you look for new talent on the stage? Like what are you looking for?
Yes, I came from theater. And so I think that's always a resource. We've been in a pandemic, and I also have been raising kids all the while I've been at the MCU. So I see as much as I can. And I would say we read, and everyone on my team, we all see everything we can now in every medium, and we read coverage of everything. So we read, you know, American Theater Magazine, and we cover all the festivals, and we cover international festivals. And so we're constantly trying to be sponges and absorb everything we can. But having come from the theater, I'm always paying attention to even Off-Broadway or West End. And there have been a number of actors that have come to us through theater. Looking for young talent, I think, or emerging talent, we're looking for really passion and intent, sort of seriousness of intent. Are they ready? Are they applying themselves? Are they disciplined? You know, again, with Tom, we knew this was going to be a big part. And I knew that he had been dancing like 8 hours a day since right. He was 9 years old. You know, he had already shown that he was kind of a professional and could go on a set and show up for work every day. It's rigorous, right? So I think there's also the skill set. Do they have charisma? Are they watchable? Do they have range? There's so, so many things that we're looking for. But I guess above all, do they really connect with the character? Are they breathing life into this character in a way that is so unique and so exciting that we feel like we have found the embodiment?
Something that I've heard from Kevin and folks who know Kevin very well is that he loves comedy. He watches a lot of like comedy TV. And I'm wondering, does he ever bring you some of these comedy folks that wind up in the Marvel? Does he ever go, you know, I was watching this, Sarah. Have you thought about this person?
It's always collaborative. And when we sit down together, everyone's always tossing ideas around. So I think that is a big part of the process too. And you know, Kevin meets with actors as well. So he will sometimes have a particular point of view for sure that he's bringing into the conversation.
All right. So then let's talk about Julie Louis-Dreyfus for Falcon and Winter Soldier. What was the process of casting her?
Very secret. Mm-hmm. And I do believe there had been some meeting or connection. And so when that happens, then it's like, where's the right opportunity? Where, you know, what could be the right role? And then feeling that out to see if that's something that everybody sparks to, right? This all works when it sparks, when it feels fun, when it feels joyful. So I think that was an amazing idea because she not only fit the character, but it was such a cool opportunity to bring her in. And frankly, I think so wonderfully surprising for the audience.
Nate Moore has gave an interview where he called her sort of this a different spin on a Nick Fury character. Is that how you were thinking of her when you were casting her?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's been one of the things that's been so fun about WandaVision and Falcon is really being able to inject all these different qualities and all these new characters and all these different ingredients and wildly different styles and tones into the MCU.
What's the longest lead you've had on a character, like knowing you have to cast a character versus that character appearing finally at long last on the screen?
Yeah, that is a tough question. I think it's probably a pretty close tie between Thor and Star-Lord. But I think Star-Lord would win. I think it was over 2 years from the time that we made our first list to the time that Chris appeared on screen.
That's a great segue into this other question I have. You talked about Tom Holland's dancing background being helpful for the physicality of it all. We all know because Chris Pratt sort of like publicly chronicled it, like him whipping himself into shape for Star-Lord. So what are some of the conversations you have about this, like physical, you're casting these demigods, these physical specimens. Paul Rudd is like, I don't know, I drank green shakes for a year. Like what are those conversations like in the casting?
Fortunately, that is really not my job. My job is to find the embodiment of the character. There's somebody else's job that is the transformation. But I would say that it informs the process, right? Because there has to be a willingness, right? There has to be a willingness to submit to the kind of intense rigors that it's going to require of you. But I haven't really had those conversations other than, and then really generally, like, do you play sports? Do you dance? Or people coming to me, you know, I remember Hayley Atwell when I first met with her before Peggy Carter in her, you know, most perfect British accent saying, you know, she was tired of period pieces and really wanted to kick some ass. Can I say that?
Yep.
So, and then she worked very, very hard. And if you look at, you know, the way Brie threw herself into training for Captain Marvel, mm-hmm. you know, it's so knowing that they have that willingness and that desire is great, but it's never on my end been a requirement ever, which is great. It's still been about let's find the person that makes this character come to life.
There isn't like a physical run a mile for me process of your casting.
Well, I guess when we've had screen tests, there might be an evaluation, you know, with the stunt department, but it's not ever, you know, been a, it might, it, again, it'll inform the process.
What about the shortest time you've had to cast a major role in a Marvel project?
Let's see, the shortest time would probably be the Hulk. I think it would be the Hulk. We found out we were going to cast a new actor for the Hulk. And Mark Ruffalo is somebody that I knew from way back in my theater days in New York, and also was a favorite Marvel actor. Everyone on the team loved him. And I'm not 100% sure how this came about, but all of a sudden it was decided that he was going to appear on stage at Comic-Con. And I think we were literally negotiating his contract as he was getting on the plane in order to pull it off. That was pretty crazy.
It's been really interesting to track the MCU and the evolution of the fan reaction to changes from comic book to screen. So I think back to the first Thor and the reaction of casting Idris Elba, and how, you know, there was a lot of conversation around the idea of putting a black man in that role. And I feel, and I hope, or maybe I'm not visiting the darkest corners of the internet anymore, that conversation has changed a lot and people are more receptive just because it's been a decade. But on your end, how do you allow for diversity in casting options when you're casting for a character that the audience is already familiar with?
Well, we're always casting the widest net possible. And we're always asking questions and we're always trying to push the boundaries. So I think it's about being rigorous. And I think casting directors have historically done that. You know, if there's a lot of male roles, not a lot of diversity, can we bring some, please, to the conversation? So I think that we are always advocating, I think, in that direction. But I also think you're right that the world has changed and the MCU has changed. And for example, when we cast Tessa Thompson as Valkyrie, I think, you know, she was so amazing and so embodied the character. And then kind of moving forward into the Spider-Man world with Jacob Batalon as Ned and Zendaya as our quote MJ. And, you know, I think that really audiences have embraced it. And I guess my goal is, you know, back to the same thing. If you can't argue with how great they are, I think an audience is going to be a lot more accepting. I hope.
Is there an instance when you're casting for Marvel where you really liked a person, but the perfect role for them didn't come around until much later?
Yeah, there are many, many, many instances. And I think, what's relevant, because we're talking about Falcon Winter Soldier, is I would say Wyatt. Wyatt's very first audition in his life was for Captain America.
And wow. Okay.
He didn't get that part at the time. He was young. But then I ended up putting him in another project where he got his SAG card, and then continue to watch him, right? That's our job, is to remember people and to continue to watch them and see the different kinds of roles he's playing and see how he's growing. So when this role came up, there's some beautiful harmony to bring him in and have him audition. And all, we, of course, we can't say very much about it. And I think he said he didn't really know what he was auditioning for, but I said there's some full circle here, Wyatt, on this role. So there's a great example. And I think Chris Pratt is another example who had come in for a different role. Lupita had come in. Karen Gillan. There's so many actors. Chadwick Boseman. So many actors in the MCU that have come in and of course, shown what's special about them. But it was a minute before that part opened up. And I would say that comes into play with all of these. And again, you know, with WandaVision, having the opportunity for someone like Catherine Hahn, who also I've been a fan of for so long. And in Falcon Winter Soldier for the wonderful Carl Lumley, you know, there's also those opportunities where there's just actors that we all know, but to be able to find that incredibly meaningful part for them in this world has been great.
I wanted to ask you a follow-up about Wyatt, if I may, because I talked to him a little bit last week about this idea of, like, when I think of Wyatt, I think of his sort of like beach bum sort of characters that he's played, right? These really like nice stoners that he's played so well. And so, you know, he pointed out that's not all he's done. But I'm curious, you know, what you saw in him other than Captain-ish, but not quite Steve, that made him a good fit for John.
Well, I think this is okay to say, like, he fought for it. He read for it. He auditioned. He did an amazing job and he showed what he was going to bring to it.
And then can I ask you, because we haven't discussed him specifically, and I'd love to, the process of finding Anthony Mackie. And you said that, like, you know, at the time when you're casting these things, you're focusing on just how can I cast a Sam Wilson? How can I cast a Falcon? That sort of stuff. Is there at all any glimmer of, okay, but also this guy is one day Captain America in the comics? Or is that just not even on your mind?
I guess I wasn't thinking at the time of that. I was thinking again about him as Sam Wilson, as Falcon, but knowing his body of work and understanding kind of the depth of his ability as an actor and complexity as a person and what he's going to bring to it, I do think that it allows us to know that we can go anywhere with him.
Has there been an audition, or what comes to mind if I say an audition that you were so sure right away that this was the person for that part?
I think the hardest one moment that describes what you're talking about was with Chris Pratt and James Gunn, because again, it had been a long, long search, and catching the right tone and finding the right voice and embodiment for the character had been so elusive for such a long time. And I had sort of had it in my head that Chris could be this guy, but Chris didn't see it and James didn't see it. And James has been very generous about telling this story where he got quite fed up with me. But then once he walked in the room and started saying the lines, it was almost immediate.
You're like, yeah, that's why I have this job. That's why I've had this job. That's why I will keep this job.
It never gets easy. I'm telling you, every single time it feels scary, you know?
Is there anything else that you want to talk about that feels kosher to talk about that we haven't touched on?
I think one of the things I would say is having the opportunity to talk to you today, because... Right. I tend to be very forward looking. What are we working on? What comes next? I don't have the opportunity to look back that much. And I think it was a fun opportunity to just take a moment and reflect on that and reflect on what have been some of the big turning points in the MCU and the ways that it's continued to, I think, surprise people and go beyond expectations. And I think that's been a really gratifying part of WandaVision and allow, you know, because that show was able to debut first and with the creativity of Jack and Kevin and Matt and everyone bringing that show to life, I think has just, it's been very exciting to, I think, see. No one's resting on their laurels. Everyone's continuing to work hard. And I think that was one of the things that really struck me coming to talk to you today was how much things have changed. And yet the pressure is still on every day, really, to continue to hit the, you know, we've set the bar so high to continue to hit it out of the park for audiences and fans.
How do you adapt to the acceleration of going from like a couple films a year to all these TV projects that you have to flesh out?
I have a great team and I've been able to expand my team. So Jason Stamey's been working with me on WandaVision and Falcon Winter Soldier, and Krista Hazar's come on to do some of the other shows. And I have Molly Doyle's been with me a long time, and I have an amazing staff that luckily has continued to grow because there are many, many more projects than there were a decade ago when I first started out.
You know, from the start, the MCU has had a lot of actors with a lot of gravitas. You have Sir Anthony Hopkins in, you know, a very early film, et cetera, you know, Jeff Bridges, like from the beginning. But there does seem to have been some sort of turning point in the increasing success of the MCU where suddenly it was, I feel like talking to actors, it's like everyone wants to be in a Marvel project. Do you know that wasn't always the case? And now it sort of seems to be the case. Does that seem accurate to you? Do you feel like you can pinpoint where the turning point was for that?
First of all, I don't think that's true.
Okay.
I'll say that. Not everyone, but many, many, many wonderful actors that we're very blessed to work with. I think the turning point continues to evolve. I think Guardians was a big turning point because it was much more comedic. I think Thor Ragnarok was a turning point. I think the Avengers films were. And frankly, I think WandaVision was, because people didn't quite know what the streaming world was going to look like. And when we first started casting these shows, I do think there were some questions and maybe a bit of reluctance. But then once the shows came out, everyone understood how sort of thoughtful and groundbreaking and creative they were. And so that's yet another turning point.
Well, thank you so much. It's such a joy to talk to you. Thank I'm you so too. Impressed by everything you do. It's a big thrill for me. So thank you.
Likewise. I'm really so honored to get to be here, and it's great to talk to you. Thank you.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Okay, so the last thing I want to do here, this is a thought prompt from one of our listeners, Christina. It's the last thing I want to put you guys on the hook for. she asks what our favorite MCU quote is. She says, mine is when Sam says, it's not a better world if you're killing people. It's just different. It reminds Christina of a Mr. Feeny quote from Boy Meets World that has stuck with me since childhood. It's not enough to survive in this cold, cruel world, because then you simply become part of it. You must have a desire to change it, to do what you need, a strong mind and a good heart. I think this is what made Steve such a good leader, and it's what's going to make Sam a good leader. So Christina wants to know, either MCU as a whole or Falcon Winter Soldier, a favorite quote. Let's start with Anthony Breznican.
I came up with something specifically from the Falcon and the Winter mm-hmm. Soldier. And it's a line that I like, because I think it's something that a lot of the characters have been asking. Although the line when it's spoken is not cool. It's when John Walker basically says, like, do you know who I am? to the guy that they're raiding. And that phrase, right, is right up there with, I'd like to talk to your manager. uh-huh. Like, oh, this is a jerk. Do you know who I am? And I think Bucky is asking that question. Sam is asking that question. Isaiah is not, it feels like maybe he has the answer to that. I'm nobody, you know, he just wants to lay low and not be remembered or not be noticed after the hardship he's been through. Sam is trying to figure out, he's circling what that question means, what his identity should be. Bucky is trying to wonder if he's defined by the worst things that he's ever done. And that question is, I think, who we as the audience, that's something we're grappling with, right? Who am I? What am I? What do I believe? What do I not know that I am? I think one of the things that Rebecca said on the Spectrum Lounge podcast was that she was glad that you said Bucky, you're glad Bucky wasn't the one that they gave, that Steve gave the shield to, that he still has work to do. And his journey in this movie, or in this series, Malcolm Spellman keeps calling it a movie, by the way, in all of his interviews. Yeah, one of the things his journey in this series reminds me of is the thing that I think a lot of white Americans who have decency or strive toward decency are asking themselves, which is like, what did I pick up that I didn't mean to? What did I learn as being a part of the system that I would like to unlearn or make sure that I don't perpetuate? And for as much talk as we have given to like carrying the legacy of Steve Rogers, I think that's zeroing in on it as one person. But if you just think about life in general, we are constantly in this continuum of the baton being handed one generation to the next. You know, life is so short, which is what you realize when you hit your 40s and you realize you're kind of at the halfway mark. And the last generation can only carry it so far. And then it's up to you to pick it up, whether you want to or not. You've got to pick it up and move it forward. And that really, where you move it is answered by the question of who am I? And so do you know who I am? I think is a defining line for me, because it's a question I think each of these characters is asking of him or herself.
Excellent. I love that. I love that. Rebecca, what you got?
It's a tie between the two, but my first one, Falcon, both of them are from Falcon and the Winter Soldier, both from episode 4. This one was towards the end of episode 4 when Carly decided to call Sarah. I think that's when she felt that Sam had betrayed her. And so she thought, okay, I'm going to call his sister so we can set up this meeting. And so Carly is basically upset. She was like, your brother is working with this, you know, new Beta Cap with John Walker. And, you know, I betrayed. And, you know, Sarah makes it very clear. She was like, my brother is not working with that man. He has nothing to do with that. And then I love what Sarah says to Carly. She says, my world doesn't matter to America. So why should I care about its mascot? And I got to tell you, throughout watching this whole experience of these all 6 episodes of Falcon and the Winter Soldier, to me, Sarah's character spoke to me. There's a connection that I have with her being this Black woman in America, but that saying pretty much crystallized how so many of us, particularly Black women, are feeling right now in this country, where it's just like, you know, we look at Stacey Abrams, someone who's just like this powerhouse, you know, even though we know that the election was stolen from her, and still got her hands dirty and was like, all right, I lost that election, but we're going to get a new president into this office. You know what I mean? So even in a world that doesn't respect her, that doesn't respect her race or her gender, she's still thinking about the greater good. You know what I mean?
But I
think what Sarah said, it was just sort of like, you know, I'm this widow, I'm trying to run this business and trying to raise these two boys, these two Black boys, you know what I mean? And so she was like, I'm not really caught up in all these politics and running around and shenanigans. And then the other one, which I think is really something that I think this saying, I feel like phase 4 of the MCU, they can't ignore this. Like it's been said, the gauntlet's been thrown, where Zemo says the desire to become a superhuman cannot be separated from supremacist ideals. Mm-hmm. That is so loaded. And then you drop that in the middle of the MCU, and you can't, I don't think you can go on and do, you know, phase 4, 5, and 6 without circling back. Like, I hope that phase 4 will kind of revolve around this idea. And just how, you know, when they're rolling out these new franchises and new superheroes, is to wrestle with this idea of when you're a superpowered person. We saw it with Wanda. It was very easy for her to go dark. You know what I mean? To use her powers to hurt people and harm people. So I'm hoping that they will keep that in mind, because I thought that was a very powerful statement.
I love that. Excellent.
Joe, what's yours?
Mine is not from Falcon the Winter Soldier, but it pertains to Falcon the Winter Soldier, I think, which is my favorite in quote in all of the MCU, is one that is shared by both Steve Rogers and Sam Wilson, and it is "On your left." It's just like, I kind of cry when I think about it. I think,
yes,
you know, it's that moment, you know, when we rewatch those like in theater videos of people losing their minds during Endgame at the end, seeing T'Challa walk through the portal, seeing Steve Rogers say Avengers Assemble. But for me, like, I started crying when I heard Sam say "On your left," you know, like that was just like, I got you. I'm here for you. I'm your guy, and you're not alone. Like, Steve Rogers is ready to take this on all by himself, but he's not alone. I'm kind of teary about this. Like, that's the emotional impact of all of this. And that's, you know, to Rebecca's earlier point, that's who Sam Wilson is, right? Like, I'm here for you. In his counselor role, in his captain role, like, Carly, I don't agree with you, but I am listening to you. You know, I'm on your left, I got you. And it means a lot to me. That line,
on your left, like, leftism is kind of like, you know, that's progressivism too. And one of the things my wife pointed out, she is a Marvel, total Marvel geek, and she pointed out that Steve Rogers' Captain America suits, the star was always like in the center of his chest. Hmm. And on John Walker, it's over to the far right.
Wow.
That's right? Interesting. Yeah.
Wow.
That's his US agent placement, but that is interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
You know, like it is on the far right. And like, so I don't know. I'm reading too much into on your left, but I think of, you know, that's where the.
Listen, read whatever you want to on your left. That's the beauty of those three words, you know?
No, I like that interpretation. I'm going to have to go back and watch.
I'll give that a shout. That's to my wife. She discovered that. She knows
that's
that.
Dope.
Yeah. So that's it. Those are our MCU thoughts and feelings and our Falcon and Winter Soldier thoughts and feelings. Obviously, like these characters are going to be springing forward. We're going to be seeing a Captain America 4 eventually in theaters. And anything like what do you most want? I guess I'll ask this one last quick question. Like, what do you most want to come from this? We get this ending moment that's very sort of uplifting of like, you know, Bucky invited to the cookout, like staring out into like the beautiful sunset sort of moment for them. But what do you want for them or from them going forward? I guess, Rebecca.
A few things. I'm going to be open and say that I am on the Bucky and Sarah shipdom train. I love them. I was just a small moment in episode 5, but I'm invested. And from what I understand that there's lots of fanfic being written about Bucky and Sarah. Rated G to rated R, depending on, you know, how your heart can handle. I've read some of them. It's pretty juicy. So I kind of want to see that relationship develop, hopefully, if that's what happens. The other thing I would love to see, because Carl Lumbly was just tremendous in the series, and I think he was such a linchpin. I don't know that the show would have worked with. We would have gotten like a buddy action show, but he just brought this levity and gravitas to the show. I would love for them to keep Isaiah as a mentor of sorts to Sam, because now that he's Captain America, I don't think his journey is over. It's just beginning, because we don't know how America is going to accept a Black Captain America. So I would love Isaiah to be a mentor of sorts to Sam, to kind of keep him on the path, right? To kind of remember, you know, where he came from and, you know, certain missions, maybe that's not what you need to be doing. You know what I mean? To kind of be his eyes and ears. And I would love to see, like, with Bucky, I'm not sure if he's going to keep the Winter Soldier moniker, because that's kind of, like, indicative of his past life. I don't know. But, I mean, Sebastian Stan, I think, because, wait, the first movie was, like, 2010, 2011. He's been with the MCU for almost a decade, right? Yeah. And I feel like he's really grown into that role. So I definitely want to see more of him and more women and more women of color in the MCU. Like I was just so excited about Tiana Paris in WandaVision. I had some issues with how they depicted her character, but I think with Secret Invasion and Captain Marvel 2, we're going to see Tiana Paris do some stuff. I'm really excited for her.
How about you, Anthony?
I have to say, like, can I just ditto all, like, all for those things? I kind of wonder what's left for Bucky to do. He's had quite a run.
I think a lot of people were really worried that he was going to die at the end of this, that was going to be the end of his arc. And I'm glad he didn't, but anyway, sorry, what were you saying?
I like this friendship between him and Sam, and I'd like to see where that goes. But really, I want to see the next challenge that Sam faces, and I'm all for more Carl Lumbly as Isaiah Bradley and Eli as his son, or grandson rather.
Yeah,
You know, we know that in the comics he becomes a superpowered individual, and so I just think it would be a shame if they created a character that powerful and then didn't bring him back for a couple more runs of story. I think there's a lot there.
Yeah.
My understanding is,
one more thing about Isaiah Bradley. I meant to say this at the beginning. Mm-hmm. The reason why I'm really fascinated about Isaiah Bradley too is that I'm sure Malcolm had his reasons for bringing him onto the show, but it's like they really put a time bomb in the MCU, because his presence is just going to be like, we're just looking at a lot of people. It's sort of like pulling on a thread of a bad cheap sweater or a rug, and it's kind of going to be interesting to see how it unravels, to know who knew what and who knew when. So I'm interested to see how they're going to tackle that in phase four.
Exactly. I'm with you guys. More call only always. I'm always interested in what's going on in Bucky's damaged little head. My favorite forever is Bucky. I would love to see him, as the token white guy of the Wakandan show. If indeed they do have their regulated token white guy in that show, I would love for it to be the White Wolf himself, Bucky. All right. Well, that is it for us. Rebecca, if folks want to hear more from you, where can they find you?
Oh, absolutely. I'm on Twitter and Instagram. It's filmfatale_NYC, both on Twitter and Instagram. And my podcast is The Spectrum Lounge. You can find it on SoundCloud, Spotify, Apple, and also on YouTube.
And Anthony Brosnahan.
You can just find me writing away at vanityfair.com.
All right. You can also find me there. You can find me on the Little Gold Men podcast, and you can find me here in the Still Watching feed talking about Kate Winslet and murder in the Mare of Easttown coverage that Richard and I will be doing going forward. And maybe we'll be getting the band back together in June, probably for Loki. But we will see all of you hopefully then.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, J. Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.